For great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. If you thought the Martians were scary, wait till you hear the truth. War of the Worlds with George Eliason and John Helmer on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
I'm George Eliason.
And I'm John Helmer.
And this is the radio broadcast from TNT breaking the news of the War of the Worlds. In front of the microphone, you won't be hearing armchair generals and think tankers paid to run propaganda for NATO and the Biden administration. Our microphone is fitted with a special filter to keep the propaganda and false expertise out. This is not the hour for repeating what you've already heard and rehashing what you already know. We aren't a crosstalk of reporters pushing their bylines in exchange for your money. We aren't the BBC's hard talk with its soft-centered confectionery manufactured at the Foreign Office and MI6. They are the alien invaders. This is the hour when you'll be able to hear the news breaking from the news fronts throughout Europe and from your ears to your brains, not the alien invaders, but the fresh, original, human analysis of what the breaking news means. So sit tight. And here goes.
George, we've got an exciting two sets of breaking news to discuss in our duet today. There's too much news for us to focus anywhere but in Russia. The first segment we'll tackle is the story of the drone attacks on the Kremlin flagpole, the dome roof of the Senate building in the center of the Kremlin. In the second and third segments, we will be looking at Yevgeny Prigozhin's statement, two statements. The first, in which he berates the Minister of Defense, Minister Shoigu, and the Chief of the General Staff, the Chairman of the General Staff, Gerasimov. So let's go with the first topic, the drone attack. Do you want to lead off, George?
Yes, on the night between May 3rd and 4th, there was a drone attack on the Kremlin that was taken down through electronic means. It wasn't shot down. Now, there was an explosion, which is, you know, if the drone didn't have any type of weaponry on it, it'd be a bit unusual, okay, considering it wasn't shot down. Now, Ukraine denied any culpability in the attack, and promptly the next day, they issued a commemorative stamp, which takes a lot of time to actually produce. You have to come up with the idea, put it to an artist or a set of artists, approve it, have the stamps themselves cut, put it to the printer with the colors, set it up, and then you have your first run. Normally, this takes, at the fastest, it takes weeks. Now, what's really important about the attack is that in February 2022, Macron had a conversation with Vladimir Putin right before the invasion and asked him if he was going to target Volodymyr Zelensky. And until that point, Zelensky was nowhere to be seen. President Vladimir Putin said no, because there is more or less a moratorium on targeting leaders in war. It's just not something you do, not something you want to do. And with this attack on the Kremlin, it seems Zelensky thinks otherwise now.
Well, let me go through some questions, George, some naive questions of fact, and let's see what the answers lead us to, because there's both more and there's less to what's happening here than meets the eye. In the first place, let's start I've got 12 questions. One, how many drones were there which detonated at the Senate building dome in the Kremlin on the evening, as you pointed out? Well, we know there are two. Question number two, how much time elapsed between the drone detonations? Well, from what I gather, it appears to be between 15 and 16 minutes. Question three, from what direction and what trajectory did each of the two drones fly at their target? I've looked very carefully at this. I've lived in Moscow long enough. I think I got the coordinates right. I think I know my left from my right. The first drone came in from the northeast. The second drone came in from the southeast. At what speed? Question four, I don't know. The experts are able to estimate speed based on the video clips, but certainly the Russian authorities can estimate speed. I would have said, looking at these devices coming in on the videos, which all our listeners have probably seen by now, and we'll give you the clips in order to watch it if in the Dance with Bears posting after the show. At what speed? I'd say slow, medium to slow. Now, measured, this is the next question, measured by the visual flame, the smoke, the sound, the debris on the dome and on the ground below, what was the relative explosive power in TNT equivalent for each drone, if any explosive at all? Now, you hinted at that, George. There may not have been an explosive charge on either of the two drones, or these explosive payloads were tiny, minuscule. Why would that be if you're attempting to create a fire of the size the Ukrainians were all prepared to claim credit for with their postage stamp? Now, we also appear to know from photography that there were security men on the dome roof just before the first drone detonation, between the first and second detonations, or maybe it was after the second it occurred. If that's correct, did they have advanced knowledge of what was coming in? And what, moreover, were they so confident of what was coming in, they exposed themselves to damage? Well, those are questions. Here's another one. What photographs of the drone debris on the roof and on the ground have been published? Easy to answer that one, isn't it? None.
Yeah.
Not a picture. That's very unusual in Russian forensic practice. Question number eight. From the debris on the dome roof and on the ground below, what was the source of the explosive? Explosive leaves traces. I'm not an expert. George, you're not an expert. We know the experts are able to trace explosive from tiny traces. There'd be trace on the Senate roof, and there'd be trace on the ground. They ought to have been able to trace it by now, but they've made no announcement. Question nine, what was the type of drone, the model, the manufacturer, and the country origin? We don't know that. There's been no official Russian statement about a matter of forensic fact, which must be known to them already based on what they found on the ground and the debris on the roof. I've heard, as many listeners will have heard, people speculate that it was a Chinese manufactured drone of the kind you can go into an electronics shop and buy, but that's worthless forensically. The more interesting question is, why hasn't the Russian government announced the origin of the drone? Why hasn't the Russian government announced the origin of the explosive material? There's been enough time. We saw much more ample disclosure after the bomb attack on the Crimean Bridge. And within a week, a very elaborate, very effective and very reliable account of how that explosive was brought by truck from the Ukraine to the bridge and blown up. for the moment, we've got nothing but nothing on this one. So question 10, from what has been learned by others, not by you and me, from the debris, the trajectory records, the flight speed, and the control mechanism, what were the launch locations, either in the Moscow area or outside it, and the distance from launch to Kremlin? This is the big question. I'm not sure we want to hazard guesses, but I've got one in my head. Now, the drone in the video of the dome attack appears, and this is part of the answer, appears to be relatively short range. In other words, these devices might or were launched in relatively short range, low trajectory, and that's why they weren't detected. Or were they detected? If short range, then they've been fired from the Moscow area. In fact, within a kilometer or two of the Kremlin in two different locations. If you imagine a launch by people using a car, they had to get from, they were either two groups or they had to move from one part of Moscow to the other, crossing the river. Okay, what about the surveillance video that would be identifiable and operative at the location guesses that the forensic investigators would have identified? There might be surveillance, street surveillance video of the launch. Is there any? We don't know. I've been told, but I can't be sure, that all GPS and other forms of mobile telephony were suppressed in the Moscow area around the Kremlin before the drone attack. If that were the case, then why was that happening then, before the drones were identifiable? Those are my, let's call them naive questions. Those are the questions, the forensic questions, the truth or falsity questions that everybody, including us, wants to ask if you want to pin responsibility on a source. How do you feel about the questions and the answers, George, at this stage?
Well, those questions are what need to be asked, and that's for sure. And another point is the fact that if you look at the video itself, when the drone lights up, it's a cold flame. It's a relatively cool flame. So, you know, in terms of explosives, I mean, it looks like there's just enough there to be ignitable. If there, you know, whatever is there, it was something, either it was just something to ignite it, to make a point. This is happening. Would be the point ahead of the May 9th celebrations in a few days. You know, it's the target is reachable, in other words.
Now, and done locally.
You get the reactions. Exactly.
No long distance firing from the territory of the Ukraine, correct? You've got tiny device, a tiny charge, and it's made to look as if it's come from the Ukraine, but on the balance of probability with the paltry evidence that we've so far got, it appears to have been launched from very close to the Kremlin. Would that be your assessment on the balance of the probabilities of what we know and don't know at the moment?
Most definitely. And a lot of the attacks that are happening inside Russia are following the same pattern. It's actors that are already there. So, you know, we'll hopefully come to the, you know, the balance of answers to these questions, but it's going to take some time on that point. Were they working in concert with the Ukrainian government or as actors for them? Well, the stamp, the commemorative stamp says everything on that point. Will the Russians be able to arrest the group or persons, singular, responsible for the two attacks? That's also a big question. So we'll see, what comes out of this over the next days. What do you think of Sergei Lavrov's statement on that, that Russia is going to respond in kind? This was a foreign attack, and they'll respond.
This is normal for the foreign ministry and the foreign minister. Maria Zakharova has also made a statement to that effect. But it's quite interesting that the Mr. Lavrov's statement and Ms. Zakharova's statement does not identify the United States behind this operation, but the Kremlin spokesman does. The reply in kind implies in kind. And there have been a number of theories of a Russian false flag that have circulated, not only in the Western press, but in the Russian media. The Western press, comprising the anti-Russian press, is basically dependent for their ideas on the Ukraine. The pro-Russian media in the United States, for example, dependent entirely on reading what the Russian military correspondence bloggers have to say, and then applying a U.S. interpretation that's usually further away from the truth than the Atlantic is wide. The notion that this was a false flag operation authorized by the general staff is wrong. I'm convinced of that. There would be no false flag of this type from that military authority because it reflects badly on air defense capabilities. On the other hand, I have a source that says there's no doubt that the air defense network around the Kremlin is so dense it would be impossible for a sizable drone moving long distance, no matter how low in altitude, to break through. So the inference is, and we're seeming to agree on this, and we're coming up for a break, so we'll continue with this after the break. The inference is this was a very small, low explosive charge, symbolic attack. A symbol was fired, and it was launched within 1 to 3 kilometers from the Kremlin, probably from a moving car, which fired twice. It's a symbol, as the postage stamp is a symbol. George, do you want to cue us, go to break, and we'll come back to this in a minute?
You should hear what Lynn Shaw is talking about.
So right now, the Earned Act I've been talking about it for a long time, just reintroduced into Congress, and it stands for, because I want you to have a clear understanding, eliminating abusive and rampant neglect of interactive technologies. It revises the federal framework governing the prevention of online sexual exploitation of children. It is out of control. It is the Wild West online. I know you know this because we all know it now, and we're hearing more and more about it each and every day. So this bill, the Earn It, would establish the National Commission on Online Child Sexual Exploitation Prevention, and the commission would develop best practices for interactive computer services that would be, you know, Facebook, Twitter, to prevent, reduce, and respond. And respond quickly to online sexual exploitation of children.
Lynn Shaw on TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
This is War of the Worlds on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And welcome back. Now, we're discussing the drone attack on the Kremlin on May 3rd and 4th. On May before the break, that it was a it's a symbolic attack, saying that the Kremlin is vulnerable. Even with the layered air defenses, it is vulnerable from the inside, is a big deal. Now, John, how do you think that the Russians are actually reacting to this specific type of attack? Because it could have been carrying a heavier payload.
Well, when you fire a symbol, and this is what this is, one has to look at what the symbol is meant to mean. And the postage stamp from Kiev is not the only meaning attributed to the firing of these two little symbols. It not only means, in Ukrainian thinking, or the British and American mainstream media thinking, that the Kremlin is vulnerable, which basically it is not, but let's say that's their interpretation, that the Ukrainians are capable of breaking through the Kremlin air defense network as they hope to break through in an offensive in your backyard in the Donbass. That's the way the symbol is understood on the other side of this war. On the Russian side, however, Dmitry Medvedev, the former president, the deputy head of the Security Council, has said this means that all reluctance on the Russian side to avoid striking at the leadership of the Ukraine, in particular Vladimir Zelensky, is now gone. And as you pointed out, George, President Putin not only assured President Macron, but he's assured a bunch of Israelis, the former prime minister of that country, that there'd be that the Russian side would not attack the president of the Ukraine. That does not mean that decapitation hasn't become a policy against the military command centers in the Ukraine, both west of the Dnieper River and east. That's been happening all along, and it's intensified as we approach the Ukrainian deadline for their so-called counteroffensive. On the other hand, there has what Medvedev said is what a lot of they're called ultras in the West, a lot of Russians think should have happened already. That is to say, Russian operations in the Ukraine should be less restrictive and more aggressive. One of the policies that's been clear from the beginning, stated by President Putin, and it has both strategic, human, and moral reason: Russia does not hit civilian targets. The Ukrainians claim so. They're wrong. That's propaganda. To target Zelensky would be a violation of that policy. Second, there's no reason why, in strategic planning of this war on the Russian side, to attack Zelensky, especially since the US is in control of Zelensky, as it's in control of the entire Ukrainian establishment. Replace Zelensky is something the United States will get around to doing if it judges it's in his interest, as they once did in their management, as the United States Army did in and the CIA in their management of the Vietnam War, as they were certainly doing in their management of the Afghan War. So there's no reason for the Russian side to hit Zelensky if the United States will simply replace him with another puppet, since it's the Russian view, Zelensky's no more than a puppet and not a very effective or powerful puppet. He's unable to control the Banderists, the neo-fascists or Nazis of Lvov, replacing... Go ahead. Sorry.
Here's a question. If the Ukrainian government, Zelensky down, You know, you have that line of succession in every government. If the government was decapitated, what's the risk of the Ukrainian nationalists? They're somewhere between neos and, you know, banderists taking over and the West losing control of Ukraine altogether. What would you think the risk would be on that?
I'll defer to your judgment, George. I'm not an expert on Ukrainian politics, certainly not an expert on neo-fascist politics between Lvov and Kiev. But let's be clear. There was an attempt by the Russian side in the early days of the special military operation to trigger what Russian intelligence believed would happen if there was a significant special forces thrust into Kiev that would trigger an internal domestic coup d'etat, a putsch against Zelensky then. It failed, and it failed disastrously. I'm certainly not identifying or exposing any military secret. Mm-hmm. It's very clear that there was a serious Russian misinterpretation of the politics in Kiev at the beginning of the special military operation. And it cost the lives of a large number of special forces who were landed and wiped out in Kiev in those early days. From that lesson, which would have been an internal putsch stimulated by a military thrust, an internal putsch has been attempted and it failed. So there's no particular reason for Medvedev and others to use the symbol, whoever fired it, as an acceleration of a policy at the top, when this policy has been carefully thought out for some time now, for more than a year. So I also don't see the evidence of a significant change in the targeting of Russian decapitation. Russian decapitation has been focused on military commands, the foreign staffs, and that leads to disrupting the so-called counteroffensive. That's the military plan. I see no way this particular symbolic operation is going to change that.
Now, there was one more leg to the symbology that we haven't discussed yet. Yesterday, Ukraine announced that 10,000 drone operators have been trained and are coming online right now. 10,000. And this, again, is after the Kremlin attack and before the May 9th parade, the victory parade. And you'll see over a million people in the streets of Moscow for that.
Right. We'll see what we'll see. We don't talk military secrets on this show. If we knew them, we wouldn't be telling.
Exactly.
Listeners can take it from us. There's a great deal we don't know. So what we're trying to do here is to break the news and the news analysis and cut through the propaganda. And there is propaganda on both sides. It's understandable. Now, the possibility that these symbols were fired by Russians attempting to change military targeting policy, there's that possibility. I don't see that, for example, Igor Strelkov, whose views on all matters are spelled out every day on his own website, or Mr. Prigozhin, Yevgeny Prigozhin's views, which he spelled out and we'll come to in a few minutes, neither of these sources, and call them ultras for the time being, have any motive to have fired these symbols. And they, in their remarks, certainly Strelkov's remarks, there's no sign that he thought, and he certainly favors a more aggressive policy towards Zelensky and the Ukrainian command staff. There's no possibility that he's conceded that it could have been a Russian operation. So I don't know who fired it, but I'm mystified at the silence on the Russian side on all the naive questions we've asked. That silence doesn't prove who did or who didn't do this job.
Well, it could well mean that they're actually working the problem, and, you know, it requires tight lips at this moment. They're not going to tip their hand. Another person that's commented on this was the head of RT, Margarita Simonyan, who said, finally, Russia will take the gloves off and actually get into the war. So you do have that sentiment, you know, a little bit of frustration.
And that sentiment, people forget, and we need to emphasize it, people forget what Russian democracy is like. We'll come to Yevgeny Prigozhin's display of democratic dissent in a minute. Russian democracy includes very loud, very articulate opposition to government, political, and military policy in waging this war. There's uniformity and consensus on why the war's being fought and why Russia must fight this fight to protect itself. But Ms. Simonyan's hardly the only one. She's one of a very large number of people who want a more, what they call, more aggressive pursuit of the war. And we've already identified Dmitry Medvedev as the proponent of this. I'm not going to get into internal Russian domestic faction fighting. I simply, neither of us will. But what I think we need to warn listeners to understand is Russia is a more active debating democracy on the war aims than the United States is right now.
Well, most definitely. Most definitely. And it's not just war. It's on everything. They're very lively in terms of political expression. Which, you know, in Western media, you never guess that, but that's the reality of it. They express their, you know, and it's within the Russian form of democracy, by the way, which is different than the English form of democracy, which is different than the American form of democracy. And it is very, very lively debates, which is a good thing.
It is indeed, and it shouldn't be misinterpreted to mean that Russia's falling apart, that the war aims are contested. Let me give you a quick example of the blackout in Washington. The Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington have stopped making press statements altogether just the day before the Pentagon Papers were released to the New York Times. For this little observation, and I think it's a powerful one, I have to thank a Greek reader who's tipped me off, and I've verified the evidence. So, Evharistopoli Manu, this is what the JCS pattern has been until the Pentagon Papers were released. In January, the JCS in Washington, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, released 15 press releases of meetings, comments, statements. In February, 9. March, 14. In April, there were just 3, stopping on April the 5th, one day before the Pentagon Papers have been released, and in May, nothing. In other words, the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the United States responsible for U.S. conduct of the Ukrainian war has stopped making statements or answering questions. Yes, there's one press spokesman, Kirby, but the blackout in Washington is a distinct difference from the active political debate, media debate in Moscow about exactly what should happen next and why.
This is War of the Worlds with John Helmer and George Eliason. We're going to take a quick break. We'll see you right after this messages.
Never forget the COVID tyranny that was imposed upon us.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Listen to this 30-second compilation and remember, and then reject the Great Reset.
Getting vaccines, it's time to start shaming them.
Because frankly, we know that we can't trust the unvaccinated.
F them, f their freedom. I want my freedom to live.
No, screw your freedom. You're a schmuck for not wearing a mask.
We have to stop coddling the morons who will not get the shot.
Shame on you.
No mask, get out.
Don't wear a mask or get off.
Listen to the voices of tyranny. Never forget those voices. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute, urging you to reject the Great Reset.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
The 9/11 terrorist attacks led to the so-called War on Terror. But there's another side to 9/11 which, unlike the mainstream media, TNT Radio won't censor. Consider Building 7, the third World Trade Center building, which collapsed later that same fateful day. Professor of Civil Engineering, Dr. J. Leroy Hulsey, led a research team which demonstrated that the official US government version of the Building 7 collapse is a scientific fraud that defies the laws of physics. This leaves us with some very troubling questions about the entire 9/11 attacks. Dr. Hulsey's team issued a final report in March of 2020. It concluded, "The collapse of WTC-7 was a global failure involving the near-simultaneous failure of all the columns in the building and not a progressive collapse involving the sequential failure of columns throughout the building."
This time, it's not the Martians invading. The new truth is more terrifying. War of the Worlds with George Eliason and John Helmer on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And welcome back. Now, we're going to get into what's going on in Bakhmut or Artemovsk. Artemovsk is what the city sign says, so we'll go with that right now. But for purposes of identification, it is Bakhmut. Now, Yevgeny Prigozhin has made a ton of progress through the city over the last months, and there seems to be a square mile and a half that right now that they're stalled at. Wagner Group is taking a lot of casualties right now, and Yevgeny Prigozhin has been very vocal about it. It's because of the lack of ammo and weaponry. And if that's not, if they don't get resupplies, he's going to pull his troops out of Bakhmut on May 9th, which is the Victory Day parade. And you want to talk about a symbolic gesture? That rings inside the Russian consciousness because it's victory over Nazism. And in front of Prigozhin right now are groups like Azov, the Foreign Legions, all these people that are there for their hard nationalist politics. That's who he's fighting. Now, how serious is this? Is he in conflict with the Russian government or isn't he? And, you know, this is a big question. What's the problem with the resupply? He's making accusations at the Duma level that senators are actually blocking his resupply. So, you know, as the days pan, you know, as the story pans out over the next few days, and it will come to a conclusion, you know, we'll find out. Another point is that his troops have been at this for months, and quite frankly, they haven't had a lot in the way of replacement troops coming in. These are the same troops that did the initial attack, and they fought all the way through. Now, Chechnya's Kadyrov is saying that his troops can replace Wagner's within a couple of hours. And that's something that can happen to give these troops a break. And, you know, honestly, it's really needed at this point. Where do you see this going, John? Politically, where do you see this going on in terms of with Kadyrov's offer? Do you think that that would be the right move and or just resupply?
I'd see it in pretty differently, George, from both the argument inside Russia and the argument outside Russia. I've read the pro-Russian groups, the propaganda organs, saying that, Prigozhin is signifying that there's a basic loss of control, loss of morale in the Russian military. That's not true. I've read pro-Russian and anti-Russian voices outside of the country saying that Prigozhin needs a rest, that he's suffering from battle stress. Mr. Prigozhin doesn't suffer from the stress of a battlefield. He appears on TV in front of films as if he's in that combat zone. He's not. He comes in and out. That's what commanders usually do. The army is not falling apart, and Mr. Prigozhin doesn't need a rest. There's no question that Wagner and its particular fighting qualities have come very close to the end of their utility in Artemovsk because the battle is almost over. But if you're familiar with the way individuals like Mr. Prigozhin speak, when Russians swear, and the first video is full of swear words, they do not accompany it, this performance, with the kind of stage grimacing that Mr. Prigozhin put on for the camera. That's performance for the camera. Maybe Mr. Prigozhin grew up watching Edward G. Robinson playing Scarface or Jimmy Cagney playing Public Enemy Number One. Most of our listeners probably never are too young to have watched them. I've watched them. Mr. Prigozhin was swearing, as he often does, as men in that situation sometimes do, but they don't look like that. That was staged. The abuse, the personal attack on Defense Minister Shoigu and General Staff Head Gerasimov, those attacks violate the Russian law. For a year now, to do what Mr. Prigozhin did has been unlawful. Bringing discredit on the Russian army is a significant misdemeanor. And there have been 4,800 prosecutions since that law was introduced a year ago, and the law was just tightened up last month. So Mr. Prigozhin is saying things for a purpose that's been authorized. Now, frankly speaking, my view of this is an American one. Do listeners know who the Tar Baby was? The Tar Baby was calling out to attract the fox or the rabbit into the bush of thorns and trap the rabbit so the fox could eat him. I think that Mr. Prigozhin, knowing that Wagner is coming to the end of its combat role in Artemovsk, has been used to draw even more Ukrainian, American, British, and Western reinforcements into the dead-end meat grinder that Artemovsk, the Battle of Bakhmut, has been for months. I don't believe the meaning of what was said in the first video. As for the second video, the announcement of the withdrawal of Wagner forces, that should be happening. Mr. Prigozhin is making it appear to be a rallying cry, a positive, and not a a withdrawal at the end of a job well done. The fact that the forces can be replaced quickly is perfectly obvious. But the need to keep the Ukrainians and their US and British minders believing that the Russian side is falling apart in the face of this coming Ukrainian counteroffensive, that seems to me to be the explanation of what we've just seen.
And in light of what you just said, it's exactly what happened. The Ukrainians are massing again at Arnamos. That's
come on in. That's the Tarbe. If anyone has read Br'er Rabbit, and I did as a kid, this is Tar Baby stuff. Or to take another well-known 19th century U.S. writer, Josh Billings, who created the old American proverb, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. The squeaky wheel gets the grease. In other words, Prigozhin is saying Wagner needs ammunition. The military analysis of that, including a defense ministry release on the subject, indicates not only that they've got enough ammunition, but the fire rates, all the stats of the operations do not substantiate that they've been cut short of ammunition, that they need rest. All troops need rest. All combat troops should have been rotated. If they were not being rotated by out of Artemovsk, then that's Prigozhin's responsibility, not the defense minister's or General Gerasimov's responsibility. Rotating troops so that they don't suffer from battle stress was the commander's responsibility. In any event, Mr. Prigozhin is very adept at applying to squeaking to get his wheels greased. That means more defense money. That means more ammunition. It means more rights to recruit people, and both from Russian prisons, from abroad, and so forth and so on. So combine the tar baby and the squeaky wheel, that's what Prigozhin is doing now. And if it works, because the Guardian of London and the New York Times, the Washington Post says that the Russians are falling apart and the Ukrainians rush more troops into the meat grinder, they're gone. Now, every day, the defense ministry in Moscow includes a line that the flanks of the Wagner group in Artemovsk are being guarded and protected and operated by the regulars and by artillery and air support and so forth and so on. What's that mean? It's not fake. What that means is that the Russians have kept open the reinforcement road so the Ukrainians would go into the Tar Baby plot more readily. And Prigozhin has just done an Edward G. Robinson imitation, and they're falling for it. They're falling for it. I'm sorry to say a lot of pro-Russian bloggers are falling for it too. But then they don't know how Russian men swear.
Now, there's another layer to this too. It was about a week and a half ago, Prigozhin announced the discovery of a Ukrainian army in Soledar that was a few kilometers long in terms of what was stored there, and he claimed he could arm literally 1 million people. So based on that, you know, the idea that he is in desperate need for armaments, you know, becomes the Tar Baby argument that you're making right now. What are your thoughts?
Well, look, abusing the leadership like Prigozhin has done isn't new. The oligarchs that have survived the losses of Berezovsky and Khodorkovsky, the oligarchs have remained in control of major strategic economic sectors in Russia, do that for a living. The idea of screaming at the leadership is something that Anatoly Chubais, the now exiled advisor to Yeltsin, started in 96. I've been documenting the way that particularly the coal oligarchs, the Russian coal oligarchs, do this whenever their companies have been responsible for the criminal negligence that causes hundreds of miners' deaths in methane explosions. They scream at the Kremlin, that means President Putin, that you impose regulation on us and we will put cities out of work. I mean, this kind of abuse is the way the oligarchs have been functioning in Russia for years, for 20 years now. So Prigozhin is simply playing that civilian trick and putting it in uniform. I don't believe that he's short of ammunition. What he is short of is a new battlefield role, because very shortly, Bakhmut will cease to be Wagner's role. What will Wagner do next? Well, there is no plan that I'm aware of, or I'm not going to tell you, but I don't know, no plan to attack cities. And in the after the Ukrainians exhaust their counteroffensive and the Russians unveil what they plan to do next, there is a very limited battlefield role for Wagner ahead. What does that mean? Less men, less income, less state budget, less of everything. And that's a problem.
Well, on that point, I disagree with you on.
Go ahead.
For this reason, Bakhmut is the gateway to Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. And Slavyansk has, you know, ultimately so much symbolism because it was the city that opened, possession of that city opened up this whole debacle in 2014. And it was first a rush to Slavyansk, the city of Slavs, and the symbolism, and control over it. And that was in Donbass, that was a city Strelkov took over and Strelkov betrayed when he left. The Ukrainians didn't want Donetsk right away. They're focused on Slavyansk because of the emotional cultural tie there makes it very, very important.
So you think that in the coming months, weeks and months, there will be another, let's call it Battle of Bakhmut, and therefore there will be a role for Wagner?
Yes, I do. Kramatorsk and then Slavyansk.
Fair enough. I don't disagree with that.
Donetsk isn't complete. Donetsk isn't complete without Slavyansk. It's just not. And that's been the local view since 2014.
And so from the local point of view, do people want to see Wagner troops, Chechen troops, or regulars? Or do they not care?
Honestly, they don't care. They'd rather see the Russian troops, obviously, but Wagner troops are very popular here. A lot of the locals have signed on with Wagner and are fighting with him. And, you know, that's across both LNR and DNR, as well as Kherson. A lot of Wagner's employment is coming from local sources now.
We're running out of time. The background music's going to come on. The curtain's going to come down. George, I think we've said as much as we can. We'll have to talk after we learn some more this coming week.
Thank you for joining us and have a great weekend. This has been War of the Worlds with John Helmer and George Eliason.
Goodbye.